CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Thursday morning. It's time for the Burning Platform, which of course is brought to you by Nando's. Nando's, of course, not only very good at making the greatest meal and the greatest chicken in the world, and it really is in the world. A friend of mine lives in America, and he said one of his favorite things to do is he will actually go to Washington unnecessarily and Chicago just to stop at the Nando's because he misses Nando's so much. And he doesn't live anywhere near Washington or Chicago. But they don't just do that well. They also are not scared to be associated with whatever is going on in the news. You've seen plenty of their advertising. It is cheeky. It is clever. And we hope that the Burning Platform is cheeky and clever every week. We get to unpack all of the current affairs and all of the things that are going on in the world around us, try to make sense of them too. And the Burning Platform today is no different to all the others where we try to do that. Last week we had a bumper episode. We had a bitter old trade unionist on, and he complained bitterly, as a bitter old trade unionist would, about how rich all his friends were and how, unfortunately for him, he wasn't also rich. Some of his friends being our current president and people like Marcel Golding and Zwelinzima Mavavi and many of the others who've done extremely well. And he hasn't, so I would also be bitter and twisted if that was me. Let's talk to Gabriel Krauser this morning.
You don't have to
be. Well, Pums, you know, if you look around and you see other people are so, so wealthy and they've become such capitalist sellouts, you know, to kind of paraphrase him, I'd also be annoyed. Anyway, this morning we're talking to Gabriel Krauser. He's no stranger to the Burning Platform. He is from the Institute of Race Relations, and he does some really interesting things there. He, among other things, goes into the various parts of South Africa and asks people questions that make the rest of us sit up and think, and hopefully will also make the rest of us get a slightly better grip on what's actually going on and how people feel about things in the polity. So, Gabriel, nice to see you again. How are you?
I'm good, man. Thank you so much for having me. And how's it?
How's it? Pumi and I were thinking about this. I saw an article of yours that was published the other day about critical race theory. It's all the term that they use? I can't think of it now. It's such a massive trending topic. For want of
it's
a much
all
more,
the rage all the right
rage.
Now.
Thank you, rage. Jesus, why didn't I think of that word? So it's all the rage in America, critical race theory. There are people who are publishing books about it. There are people, a whole lot of terribly guilty white people who are reading all those books, and then they go on the internet and they say, I'm doing the work, and they show that they're reading this book about critical race theory by Ibram Kendi, or there's the one called White Fragility, and it's a massive, massive industry in America. Corporations are hiring these people to help explain how race and critical race theory is an important part of dealing with shit in America. What is your finding? Because you've published this report called Critical Race Theory and Race-Based Policy, A Threat to Liberal Democracy. What have you found in speaking to ordinary South Africans?
Okay, so two caveats. The one is that this report, which you can find on the IRR site, is by Anthea Jeffrey, and it is 30 pages long. It's a serious, in-depth, deep dive, and Dr. Anthea Jeffrey is a legal scholar who's trained here and abroad in the UK. And the reason that matters is because critical race theory emerged as a legal theory, really crystallized in 1989 at the first Critical Race Theory Convention, but dating, you know, it comes back from the Frankfurt School, which took some Marxist ideas and some good ideas, like you need first-person narratives to make sense of the numbers, and I'll try and do a bit of that here too. But yeah, absolutely, you're right. It was something that had been growing in America's universities, and I experienced some of this when I studied in America. I studied critical race theory for a summer in Ireland through Princeton University, and it was kind of trendy amongst hip youth, but it hadn't gone mainstream and hadn't gone corporate, and it hadn't gone political in the same way that it is today. As Anthea Jeffrey puts it, this theory has now been injected into the citadels of power. So we see critical race theory being espoused very much by Joe Biden's administration. We see very much a takeover of critical race theory in the mainstream in many of the mainstream American newspapers. What we that's the first caveat. The second caveat is that, yes, I am an investigative journalist, and that means that sometimes when I can, I go out into the countryside, into rural South Africa, into urban South Africa, and ask people what they think. I try and figure out things about stories. But that's going to produce anecdotes. Mm-hmm. It's not going to produce data. To get data, you need to ask thousands of people. So we asked 2,500 people, demographically representative sample. And we didn't ask them ourselves because we have a clear ideological view. Right. We are non-racialists. That's what we stand for. What's on the box is what's in the box. Mm-hmm. So we hired an independent company, Mark Data, which has been in the business for 30 years. Okay. It does surveys largely for corporates. And, you know, I think that has a kind of credibility, actually. And they went and did these face-to-face interviews with people in the language of their choice with a randomly selected demographically representative sample of South Africans.
All right. You've established the credibility there. And I mean, Anthea Jeffrey's written some really interesting things about inter alia, BEE, which I think have become useful to many of us in trying to ascertain whether things are good, bad, or ugly. So you've established that credibility. What questions did you ask people in this survey?
So the first question we asked is, what do you think is the major problem that is unresolved since 1994? Unprompted, you just say what you want to say. No list to pick from. Say what you want to say. Over 50% of South Africans say unemployment. If you break that down by race, it's very much the same, 56% of Black South Africans and so on. And just note, the exact number, 56%, don't read too closely into that. It could be that it's actually 51% or 59%. You know, there's a margin of error.
Sure.
Okay. Unemployment first, crime second, corruption third, education, housing, water, these all come in. And if you keep going down the list, at number 15, you find racism with 3%. So it's a very small minority identified racism as one of the two major issues that they think is not being resolved.
Now, if you watched the news, or if you were paying attention to the politicians, you would think that race would be right up there, maybe top five, maybe even top three.
Yeah, I really like a grand old journalist who was my writing mentor for many years, Rian Malan, who wrote My Traitor's Heart. He said to me when I first started in journalism, he said, the thing to know is that the Rainbow Nation is dead, and the tombstone is the Daily Headline, because the Daily Headline declares South Africans hate each other. We're on the brink of a race war. White monopoly capital's dominating, or black race nationalism is crushing everything. Racism is the big issue. That seems to be the daily story. That does not seem to be the daily experience of South Africans. So then next question that I think is very interesting to try and explain that difference is, have you personally experienced any form of racism over the last 5 years? 80% say no. And 80% of black South Africans, 81% of black South Africans said no, 83%, 87% of colored South Africans said no, and similar figures for Asian and white South Africans. So I think that's part of, I think that's encouraging.
Sure.
Clearly, when 20% of the population says that they have experienced in the last 5 years some personal aspects of racism, that's a problem, but it's not the major problem it's made out to be on the mainstream media, in parliament, and so on. So then we said, okay, so it's not nearly as big a problem as politicians and so on make it out to be, but is it a problem? Well, how do we solve this problem insofar as it's not the major problem?
Mm-hmm.
And we asked, with better education and more jobs, the present inequality between races will steadily disappear. Do you agree? 73% said yes. Only 11% disagreed, and 15% neither agreed nor disagreed. And going back to the racial breakdown, over 70% agree that just with better education and more jobs, the present inequality between races will steadily disappear. And that's 72% amongst black South Africans, 80% amongst colored South Africans, 78% amongst Asian South Africans, 72% amongst white South Africans.
Right.
So again, what I take to be a very encouraging result, because clearly you have people sort of thinking that the non-racial path is the right way to go.
Okay.
But just to be perfectly clear, we asked again, the races need each other for progress and there should be full opportunity for all. 71% agree with that. And that's an interesting finding, because if you go back to 2000, there was a famous survey where people were asked, do you think that apartheid was badly implemented, but it's basically a good idea? In other words, races shouldn't work together. People should separate and go out their own way. And at that time, a majority agreed. And between then and now, a supermajority now disagree with that. Only 11% agree and 72% disagree with the thought that apartheid, that the good version of apartheid, if there can be such a thing, is a good idea at all.
Jesus.
So I think that's great. And then if I can do one more just before a further breakdown, we said, what's the best way to improve lives? Because this is still in the level of values. Now we're thinking about policy. And here we did give a list. We said, here's a list of four things, and you choose one as the best way to improve lives in this country.
Okay.
First option, more jobs and better education. Second option, better service delivery. Mm-hmm. Third option, more BEE and affirmative action in employment. Fourth option, more land reform. Now, if we were asking Parliament, you would have a majority saying more land reform or more BEE, some saying more service delivery. And some would say more jobs and better education. But the breakdown when you ask ordinary South Africans is 73% say more jobs and education are the best way to improve lives. 18% say better service delivery. And only 3% say more BEE. And only 4% say more land reform. So,
okay, but Gabriel,
I mean, it's clear as day.
Okay, so this is fascinating stuff, and I have no reason to doubt. You've broken it down nicely. You explained to us how you did the survey, that you guys didn't even do it yourselves. It was independent. These findings are interesting, but the people who are interested in critical race theory and the people who draft those headlines that are on the tombstone of South Africa's Rainbow Nation, those people will say, oh, but the way you phrased the questions, you know, they're going to find reasons to make it seem that you've prejudiced critical race theory. Can we just start? Because I think it's a good question here, and then I'm going to hand over to Pumi. But Duncan wants to know, what is the actual definition of critical race theory? Can you explain that to us? And how in academic circles it's explained to students?
Okay. I'm happy to do that. I'm sorry I'm disappearing from the screen.
No, it's okay.
I just saw that my laptop's about to die.
Oh, shit.
And so I have to plug it in. Okay. Yeah, I have the cable.
Okay, no problem. This is great to watch. We could see you in action. All right.
Staying alive.
The pressure's on.
What is critical race theory?
Yeah.
So critical race theory has, let's say, three key tenets. And the first key tenet, which I think is the most important, is that racism was this overt thing entrenched by governments through laws. And it was, you know, people, no one was ashamed to say in the public square that one race is superior to another.
This is true. This is basically true through human history, right? That no one's going to argue with that.
No, certainly not me. And then they say what happens is, in South Africa and America and all around the world, as the laws become more non-racial, as sort of rule under, you know, equality before the law becomes the norm, that doesn't mean racism goes away. It means it becomes insidious. But importantly, the key tenet is it doesn't decrease.
Yeah.
It's not less of a problem. It's not less prevalent. In fact, it's everywhere. Everywhere that you look around, there is racism. You just have to put on your x-ray glasses to see it. And so the critical race theory answer to the problem of our polling is basically that black people have false consciousness and white people have false consciousness. If they think they haven't personally experienced racism, that's just because they're too stupid to realize it. If they think that the best way to improve lives is by better education and more jobs, that's just because they're too naive to appreciate that if you just grow the economy in something like a meritocratic way, you're always going to have white people on top and you're always going to have black people on the bottom. That's their supposition. And here's one way that I could make sense.
That seems to me a little bit racist to imagine that if purely on merit, you let people do their thing, that black people will end up at the bottom and white people end up at the top. That's demonstrably untrue.
Well, so exactly that. It's demonstrably untrue. It might have turned out to be the case. And I think this is an interesting – if you put yourself in the shoes of someone in the 1900s, just before World War One,
right,
when Europe was about to blow up into its own kind of race war, the Slavs against the Teutons, the Anglo-Saxons and the Gaels and the Italian –
And there was a lot of eugenics going on and hard Darwinism and –
All that terrible stuff. Now, you might have thought to yourself, you know, the whole world is largely being ruled by divine right kings and queens. There's very few democracies, and where there are democracies, they've been pretty overtly racist. Mm-hmm. Maybe it turns out that human beings are like this. Genetically, we might not be different across races, but we might be like genetically racist. It might just be the case that it's very, very hard for human beings not to judge each other by the color of their skin. It's very easy for us to sort of go along with the program that was around at the time, that, mm-hmm. that's kind of baked into our nature, that we're just naturally, perversely, terribly racist beings. Mm-hmm. If that had turned out to be true, then I think critical race theory would be able to draw on a lot of evidence to support its conclusions, not just like anecdotes, which then are made to stand for everything, mm-hmm. But actual demonstrable data. They'd be able to go out and survey people, for example, in a place like America or South Africa, and find that most South Africans are like, no, dude, we don't mustn't work together, and jobs are not really the problem, racism the problem, because it's like we're naturally just racist. It turns out that that's not true. It turns out that human beings are pretty good at getting along. We're also really, really good at making little teams where we do have an us-them grouping. But those teams can be oriented on along a wide variety of axes. And in this regard, critical race theory has tried for many years to reject one of the most famous sociological analyses done around the time that critical race theory came to bear in the 80s and 90s, where a bunch of school kids in America on a summer camp were, this was the experiment done on them. They said, look, you guys that have green, everyone was white. They said, you guys who have green and blue eyes, you're on one team, and you guys who have brown eyes, you're on another team. And your teams need to compete. And at the end of it all, you know, the best team is going to get a lack of prize. And let's see how that goes. And it becomes Lord of the Flies. Within 5 days, they had to terminate the experiment because the children's lives were at stake, because right. they had become so vicious and cruel with each other. Mm-hmm. It is amazing how quickly you can program someone into a kind of us-them game where they become very, very nasty. The nicest thing about that study is that they did a follow-up a couple of years later, and They found that all of those cliques and groups and whatever that had been built through this artificial team construct had then dissolved, because kids just found it so natural to then make other groupings, the nerds versus the jocks, or the ones who like this kind of music versus the ones who kind of like that music. It was very fluid.
Okay.
And various other studies have supported that result. So it turns out that we can reorient our core patterns of loyalty. And that's one thing that I think our surveys over the last two decades in conjunct with others show, is that South Africans really were more loyal to their race 25 years ago, largely. The grand project of nation building, which is, I think, a word that has been so monopolized by a certain kind of political cabal and then discredited that no one uses it anymore. But it's actually happened. People have found themselves more loyal to their country than their race, and to other groupings, for example,
Hand over to Pumi, because there's a lot going on here, and I'm sure she's got a bunch of questions and a bunch of comments to make. So Pums, over to you, and we can pick up again once Pumi's had a go, because I think, you know, otherwise it's so much info, Gabriel, that my head's about to explode. Pums?
It's early in the morning.
I know.
No, you know, I mean, for me, there were two things when I started reading the report yesterday, but I'll come to that. Let's talk about the definitions of critical race and exactly the example that you use. I think what we forget is that human beings, like all animals, are survivalists. Trying to survive. Hence, in the game, when there were two groupings and there was a clear competition that they had to go after, the kids were loyal, so loyal to their group that it became a Lord of the Flies. And it's like that in the world too. So in South Africa, it's like that. Is you're loyal to the thing that's going to allow you to survive. And unfortunately, we have a divide in South Africa where survival is also very much skewed on racial lines. And that's a historical thing. So, and I'm asking myself as I, you know, read your thing, is if racism is so low on the priority of people's survival instinct, what are you trying to solve? It's not a problem. What are you trying to solve?
I love that question. What we want to solve at this stage in our history are the problems that are the most urgent, that make people the most desperate. So unemployment, to my mind, is the most urgent problem in South Africa. Most South Africans my age and younger don't have a job or not in education or training. I know a little bit about what that's like. I was unemployed for about 6-9 months in my mid-20s. I made a kind of career change, wanted to be a journalist, couldn't find a job, was working really hard, ended up doing manual labor to try and make ends meet. That piece jobs didn't hold it together. And I was in a relatively cushy position. I know especially what it does to young men. The lack of a sense of self-worth, the lack of a sense that I can contribute something to society that is validated by getting paid, the sense that I don't actually belong here because I can't find the same kind of place as my peers that have risen up the ladder. It's a desperate thing, and that's not even to get into the effects of malnutrition, of a lack of safety if you're sleeping on the streets and so on and so forth. So unemployment is the most urgent problem, to my mind. And then we can go down the list. We ask, that's why it's so important to ask South Africans, what do you think is the route to solve the most urgent problems? Do you think it's more BEE? Do you think it's more race-based policy? Or do you think it's better education, for example, and the kind of structure that will increase the total jobs base, which to my mind is non-racial policy for the simple reason that every investor conference and analyst that we've spoken to says that it is a determinant to investment. BEE is a determinant particularly to foreign direct investment and also at this stage to some local divestment because of the kind of association that it's come to have with corruption. We have also asked our respondents the very precise question. Do you think in terms of education, because the problem of unemployment is directly tied to the fact that our schools have, our public school system has become the world's worst on a bang for buck basis, as The Economist put it. It is the chief line item on the budget. We spend a quarter of all our national money on education, and yet we guessed terrible results. Something like 4 or 5% of students who started in grade one in 2008 finished with a matric pass in mathematics 10, 11, 12 years later, whatever it is. That is not a good situation.
No.
So we asked people, what do you think is the best way to solve this problem? Do you think it's a voucher system where the government will give you the equivalent amount that they spend per student in public schools, and then you can take that and go to any school you find, any private school, and you can pay with that voucher to send your kid there? So it's not going to be like a St. Stithians or Hilton kind of fee, but you'll have 1,000 rand a month or 2,000 rand a month, whatever it is, coming from the government for you to spend at a private school of your choice. So you don't have to leave your children there where the teachers don't come up to school on Monday and they leave on Pooza Thursday. You can send them wherever you want. Or more BEE.
Yeah.
70-80% of the respondents said, we want the vouchers.
But that's a bit of a false equivalence. I mean, like, you know.
The real problem is the problem that we're trying to solve. Is the problem of poverty, is the problem of unemployment, is the problem of poor education. And it's our view that the way to solve that problem is through a system of programs. We've laid this out actually in another long policy document called EED, Economic Empowerment for the Disadvantaged. We think that if you really go on a needs-based basis and find people with real needs, you can then pragmatically meet those needs. South Africa is not the first country to be in the kind of disastrous situation that we're in.
Yeah.
South Korea, Ireland, in fact, most of Europe after World War II, countries have been in situations where they're poorer than us, and where they've had higher inequality than us, where they've had worse literacy and education rates than us, and so on and so forth. And they have solved those problems by addressing those problems. And we believe that if you do that here, it will work just the same. In fact, we think it'll work better in part because we are such a fabulously interesting country. I think that aspect of it does have an advantageous.
I don't think we're very encouraged and heartened
by the fact that most South Africans seem to agree with us.
Gabriel, I don't think Pumi's disagreeing with you about what our most urgent needs are, but I do think her question about race and why we're focused on it is important and interesting. So the report is not called "The Biggest Problems in South Africa." ranked from 1 to 15. It's called critical race theory and race-based policy. So I want to just quickly go back to race for a second. It does seem like we've gone through an enormous shift in attitude in the world, not just in South Africa, but maybe South Africa's played a large part in that. And correct me here, guys, if either of you think that I'm wrong or if I'm stretching a bit. The fact is, during my lifetime, racism has become so unpalatable in every quarter. I do not know of anyone brave enough or stupid enough to be overtly racist in any public forum or even in private fora, for that matter. Certainly, I don't know everybody. Certainly, this is anecdotal.
There are many.
Pums, I think there's an undersupply and an over-demand for racism if you look at kind of the things that the media are looking for. Like, I don't meet people on a daily basis, even on a monthly or week or year or annual basis, who are overt out-and-out racists, because those people have been made, to use Mandela's words, the skunks of the world. You know, thanks to social media, there's such an opprobrium to these people now, and rightly so. I think the whole attitude to racism has changed significantly, and we perhaps with the benefit of hindsight, but the inability to take in that hindsight over a period of time because our memories are useless, we don't appreciate just how far we've come. To take an overtly racist stance on anything these days is to end your career, to assign yourself to the moral low ground, and to lose friends, actual friends. It impacts enormously and in the best ways, I think, on people when they are overtly racist. They are basically pariahs, and that we don't take enough cognizance of. This is important, especially in a country like ours, where race was the defining characteristic of how people were treated and how people treated you for thousands of years, right? Hundreds, certainly, but maybe even thousands of years. It's amazing to see that now, and I think that's not without an enormous amount of effort. It's not without changes in policy. It's not without the evolution of the way we think about each other. And it's not without freedom in South Africa, which I think played its part in the international sphere when it comes to that. People like Nelson Mandela, people like Barack Obama, those are the obvious ones to go for. But I think we've come a long way. In this country, it pleases me to know that race is like a 3% worry to most people. But your question still stands, Pums. Why then the focus on it?
So I think that a nice old line is that the most common mistake that generals in war make is that they fight the last war. And if you study a little bit of military history, you really do find that the Brits in the Anglo-Boer War, for example, they were fighting with the lessons that they learned in the 1870s, fighting in Afghanistan and whatnot. If you look at World War I, people were fighting with the lessons that they learned in the Boer War. And those ones who stuck to those problems then lost. In World War II, the poor French were completely flattened in 6 weeks. Why? Because they were still using World War I tactics during World War II.
Yeah.
This is not just a problem for generals. It's a kind of human problem. The easiest battle to win is one that's already played out. So I think in large part what's happened in South Africa is that racism was the number one problem. Pretty much since this country's union in 1910 until somewhere in the last three decades.
And then it stopped being a major problem. Are you then not in the same situation? Here you have a 30-page report based on what you admit is a 3% problem. You've got a 30-page report on it. You know what I'm saying? You're in the same place. When you did your study and you found that the biggest problem that people are talking about, have top of mind for them, is unemployment and safety and number 15. Is race, and yet you decide that the report you are going to put out at the end of it is going to be about race. Not only is it going to be about race, it is going to be titled Critical Race Theory. So you've chosen the number 15 thing.
Is that a marketing marketing decision? I mean, that because then that would explain it. If you wanted people to pay attention to it, then I understand. But then you're playing the same game as the media. It's like clickbait. Is that what you're doing?
Yeah. No. I really like this question. So I distinguish quite clearly between racism and race-based policy. That's one distinction. So you can have a country where no one's a racist, but the law is racist. The law says we've got to discriminate one against another. People who look like this need a leg up. People who look like that need to take a back seat. And that is the law in South Africa. And our president has promised that that is going to continue to be the law for as long as he's in charge. I also distinguish between racism and critical race theory, which is, on its own version, an ideological viewpoint, something which has been argued in the academy and which is then translated into policy, as has been the case in the US, where you sort of have vaccination programs, for example, that are trying to discriminate on the basis of race, where you have education programs that are being rolled out that are basically asking for students to act in different ways according to their race. So to me, the law is its own entity. People are their own entity. It ought to be the case that the law reflects the best interests and values of the people. That's what democracy means. I remember when I was studying in America, a famous Princeton study came out, which argued that America is no longer a democracy. It is an oligarchy. And the way that that argument was made was by surveying 1,000 polls and looking at what Americans' values and preferences were along a wide variety of questions: gun rights, abortion, affirmative action, healthcare, education, just the whole gamut, and looking what are the values of Americans, what would they prefer, and what are their laws. And this study found that there was no relationship, that there was a zero effect relationship between what ordinary people wanted and what the laws were. How did they explain that? By reference to lobby groups, by reference to special interest groups, political capture. In other words, you can live in a country where the law doesn't reflect the values of the people because the law makers have been captured by big business and others. Mm-hmm. That seems very much to be the case in South Africa. I think it's very important to debate race-based policy. That is a big obstacle to economic growth.
Pums?
And but you have a choice. But you, as the Institute of Race Relations, and your stated objective is to help foster better race relations, right? Amongst the people, it's the stated objective. And you have a choice. Mm-hmm. You can either shine a light on racism and what you term to be a race-based policy and what good it is not doing, or you could choose to shine a light. And by your own admission, you're saying when you asked people what could change race relations for the better, and education was one of them, and employment is another. And instead of choosing to shine a light on that and crafting policy around that, which would move us forward, you're stuck at saying you guys are doing this thing wrong, instead of saying here is an alternative and this is what we could be doing better.
I should have been more clear. We have crafted EED, economic empowerment for the disadvantaged. We crafted that about 10 right. years ago.
Guys, I'm just going to stop
doing
this. I'm going to stop this
because
I think we're in danger of talking about the IRR instead of talking about these findings or about South Africa. So I take Pumi's point, and I'm in agreement with her about, you know, the marketing, the framing of this thing. But I do want to get to let's drill down into some of these things, because I think that there are interesting subjects in here that perhaps South Africa would like to know more about. And there are things that have political ramifications. Can we just for a moment turn away from the survey and look at some of the current affairs, look at some of the stories in the news? Because I believe this is, you know, the most useful thing about the Burning Platform. We do learn new things, like this report that you've just published. But occasionally we also need to make sense of the things that are going on around us and that the media are telling us about. So let's just quickly refer, Pums, I know you're so bored with this, but the ANC, I mean, listen, guys, I almost don't know what to say on a weekly basis, because just when you think that the ANC can't shoot itself in another body part, It does. It finds a new place where it hasn't shot itself yet, and then it shoots itself there. So this week on Monday, Jacob Zuma went to court, and it turned into a rally with him and Yengeni and Ace and that silly Carl Niehaus. What do we make of the latest developments there? Is there anything new, Pums? Is there anything that we need to know?
there's nothing new under the Jacob Zuma sun.
Okay.
So once again, we have Jacob Zuma standing up and saying, I'm ready to go to court. I'm ready to stand trial. Mm-hmm. I'm ready at all. But in the meantime, right, I'm not willing to stand trial if the prosecution is not who I think is the right person, is because that's the section 106 I've come to understand is actually him fighting the prosecutor's authority to be the prosecutor in this case. If it's not the prosecutor that's the problem, then it's the judge that's the problem, then it's the court that's the problem. But hey, I'm ready to stand trial. I'm ready to stand trial.
Yeah, I want my day in court. I demand my day in court. This is what all of them say.
Which, you know, and it's more of the same. It's
okay,
it's
but what do you like? What do you make of
how can I pass this back down the road until, well, probably until I'm dead at his age? He's probably hoping he can.
He doesn't want to be accountable.
He
for
can
these
evade
things.
The law.
So, Pums, what do you make of the coalition that's coalescing around him? I mean, we knew that he and Ace were close because they were bosom buddies during his administration. The Premier League was what kind of made it happen, but there are other people who are creeping across, and there are people who are leaving that coalition and moving across the Cyril Ramaphosa side of things. Is there anything surprising about that for you or not,
guys? A coalition of thieves making revolutionary sounds. A coalition of thieves All making right. revolutionary sounds, you know, radical economic transformation, making those sounds just as something to hide behind, to hide their thievery. That's what we are.
Gabriel, anything to add on that before we move on?
Yeah, I can't help myself. We asked our survey respondents, do you think all this talk of racism and colonialism is just a way for politicians to seek excuses for their own failures?
Mm-hmm.
And a majority said yes. I do think that if there's one thing to say in favor of Zuma, it's that much like this trade unionist, this bitter trade unionist that you mentioned at the start of it all, I think he does have some reason to feel unfairly treated. I don't think anyone can seriously argue that Zuma was alone, or that it was just him and Ace, or that it was just a few people that have been spotlighted in the media that were corrupt. There's demonstrable prima facie evidence of corruption against more than half of the members of the National Executive Council of the ANC. And it does, to my mind, seem as if, and this is not a new development, over the last 8 years or so, there's been a concerted effort to try and shift all of the blame onto one or two bad apples. Then promise that we can get rid of those bad apples, and then everything will be good again. And from the perspective of one of those bad apples, it must feel kind of crappy to have stolen money with the next guy and the next guy and the next guy, and then you are the one who's targeted, and the other two flip to the Ramaphosa faction and are kind of venerated or excused. I don't think that's a legal argument, but I do think that there's a kind of something going on.
You know what they do have on their side? Take them down with you.
Right.
I completely agree.
This is the thing, Pumps. So do you think that there are people...
Then go down.
Yeah, there are people... There are probably... Jacob
Zuma...
You need
the prosecuting authority to help.
Jacob Zuma has been threatening...
You need the prosecuting authority to offer immunity.
So Jacob Zuma has been threatening from the get-go that he knows information about this one and this one and this one. He knows where all the bodies are buried, blah, blah, blah. And he probably does. But...
Then he must,
make
he must
it happen.
Tell us who they are. Let them all go down.
But it's not up to him. Any criminal, anyone who's facing criminal prosecution that has the ability to bring down a whole lot of other people, they're only one side of the hand clapping. You need two hands to clap. You also need an NPA to then come forward and say, look, if you don't do this, you know you're going to jail.
The NPA.
And if you do turn state's witness, then we will keep you out of jail. You can go and retire in Nkandla nicely. But then we want 1,000 people to go down. We want evidence. And if Jacob Zuma By the way, Mark Data did a poll on this in 2017. And most South Africans thought that if Jacob Zuma turned state witness and tanked like 1,000 corrupt officials that are still in charge, they would be more than happy for him to sit pretty and sit down and die in Nkandla with his family around him. And I very much agree with that.
Yeah, I don't have any axe to grind. I feel like he is a scapegoat for so many others. And Pumi and you are both right about that. But please, the National Prosecuting Authority. I mean, Pums, there's another thing you and I are sick of talking
Hello,
about.
Hello, Gareth.
Aren't we sick
Hello,
of talking
Gareth.
About that? Shamila Batoy. If that name comes up anymore, this is the most irrelevant person in the universe. She's done absolutely sweet fuck all. You talk about two hands to clap. I think that there are people in this country who've been waiting to applaud her with bated breath. We all had such high hopes. She's done nothing. She is a complete letdown in every way. Okay, so ANC's off the menu. Let's move on. This is interesting. There have been in Bloemfontein this week, and I want to acknowledge for all our listeners in Bloemfontein what a shitty week they've had. The Mangaung municipality is under administration this week. There are massive water problems, massive electricity problems. Service delivery is zero in that city at the moment. There are also shops that just do not have any goods on the shelves.
And how's the underreporting on the absolute chaos that's ensued?
Now, I kind of wish we had Lieto on because he's in the Free State. And, you know, we had him on just a couple of weeks ago. And he was saying, like, he doesn't even know what to say anymore about the Free State. It's such a complete disaster. And this is wanton destruction by Ace Magashule when he was premier that has completely eviscerated any capability of service delivery in that province. The people of the Free State have had enough.
But this is the thing. Gareth, and I've said this before, that the circus, the three-ring circus that is ACE and the ANC and actually is a distraction. Because that's why I'm talking about the underreporting of what's happened in the Free State and what's happened in Mangaung and Bloemfontein over the past couple of days. Because everybody's in Pietermaritzburg. Everybody wants to cover that. Everybody wants to talk to Ace. Everybody wants to talk to Jacob Zuma. And we've got tweets and tweets and tweets. And every second headline is about what's being said by who and the prosecutor. Now we know what Section 106 is, you know? But is anybody talking about the kid that was shot dead on Monday in the protests?
I mean, we know about it. I'll give credit because I saw this on the TV news. I saw it on ENCA, and I'm not giving that channel a plug just because I've got a show on there. But that's where I saw it. I don't see nearly as much reporting, though. And Pumi's right. Like, what culpability do the media have in using clickbait stories, in only paying attention to the personality politics? Because they know that sells, and they're in business as well. What culpability do they have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a crisis of faith in the mainstream media, I think, for that reason.
Absolutely.
Crisis of faith.
Yeah.
I think people who our jobs allow us the time. They afford us the time to dig deeper and to really cover a broader ambit of news coverage. For people with other jobs who depend on an hour a day or whatever it is to kind of get a sense of what's going on that's really important. I think a lot of people just feel like they're being let down, like they are living in a more and more shadowy world with little spotlights curating the information that they're supposed to attend to in order really to, sustain a commercial system, but also to sustain a narrative. And I do think that if we haven't asked people, do you trust the headline news? I suspect that most people would say no. And I think that lines up with what we have asked, where most people just seem to have a very different picture on a personal level of South Africa compared to what the headline outbreaks are. And I don't think that that's a good thing. I think that that's a problem that has to be solved. Societies that do well are societies that have a latent level of trust, which is potent and significant, so that people don't feel like they're navigating the space alone and like they have to, you know. It also makes it tempting to fall for silly conspiracy theories and the worst kinds of.
Well, I'm glad Pumi brought this up because otherwise we would be talking about Jacob Zuma the whole way through this episode. Guys, I am loath to go there, but it is the biggest it is the biggest international story. And if we ignored it, we would be in dereliction of duty. There is shit going down, as there always is in the Middle East, but it is flared up again. It is more partisan than ever in South Africa and in the world. It seems to me that people are dividing along all kinds of ideological lines, along all kinds of tribal lines, along all kinds of religious lines around this. It is more complex than I can ever remember it having been, although it's a perennial problem. Israel and Gaza, what's going on with Hamas, with Benjamin Netanyahu, it's complex. It's by no means a simple thing. And I'm actually just not ready to talk about this, but we have to. Because if you talk about it, all it does is it gets you a huge amount of hate from the one side and a huge amount of love from the other, if you have that point of view. If you have the other point of view, it gets you a huge amount of hate from this side and a huge amount of love from the other. There's just no middle ground for anyone to understand this. Please, can either of you shed some light on things that we may have missed, or help us to figure out a way to make sense of this and to have conversations that add value? Because I can't say anything without getting into trouble on this matter.
Yeah, no, I doubt that any of us can. I think one thing to notice is that this does seem to be like the blue eyes, brown eyes thought experiment writ large, or sociological experiment writ large. It's like everyone has to be on red team or blue team. And if you don't belong nicely, if you try and straddle the lines, then you're also part of the problem. And I think that itself is something to confront, to notice, and to try and sidestep. Try and look for really universal standards of values that can help navigate the conversation. In my best attempt to do that, I find myself being on the side of Palestinians and of Israelis, not so much being on the side of Hamas. In fact, feeling like they are a major threat both to Palestinians and to Israelis. They are a terrorist organization. They do not adhere to anything like the rule of law, either outside or inside of war. They've got no respect for democracy or civil liberties. The Israeli leadership is clearly, there's blue water between that and Hamas. But the Israeli leadership also leaves a lot wanting. The scandals around Netanyahu, the inability of the Knesset to form a government in the last several years, and they keep having re-elections because they can't get it together, I think is a sign that most Israelis agree indicates that their leadership is in a crisis situation as well. So at least that's kind of 4 points of similarity. I think that the hardest thing for, at least the position that I take, which I think is in some senses the most controversial, although it seems super obvious, is that my empathy for the Palestinians looks something like this. I think, Lord have mercy. The guys on the other side are launching targeted missiles at buildings around me, and they make some knock drop effects to try and conceal me from that. But look, people are still dying. Children are still dying. Sure. I could be one of them.
Absolutely.
But also, my own supposed leadership might kill me just as readily or use me as a human shield. So I'm damned on both sides. And right. I think that if one empathizes with that position, then the kind of geopolitical analysis that follows is not going to seem one-sided in the way that that so much of this often does.
Pums, what do you say?
Weird view.
I feel like Bibi has become like Jacob Zuma, indefensible. Indefensible. I mean, he's been unable to form a government in 2 years. He's got corruption charges hanging over him. And he's just making bad decisions, left, right, and center. He's become like Jacob Zuma. And, you know, the situation there is, it was bound to get to this. So everybody's been talking about Israel's Iron Dome. But actually, guys, there's so much weaponry in that Middle East that it's a tinderbox in any way. So yeah. Israel has gotten better. But Hamas has also got access to better weaponry too. So it's a shit show. It's a clusterfuck over there. And there is Gabriel.
No, it's, you're right. You're right.
You know, I want to add to that because I don't.
And it's so polarized.
I don't know.
People are so jealous of their hurts, right? And their fears that they cannot open up their minds to what fears either side has, mm-hmm. what real danger on either side, because they are so jealous
emotional
of their position.
Yeah.
So jealous of their position that if you say anything, oh my God, it's pro Palestinian, therefore it is Zionist. You know, if you say this, then you, it's not a binary
well,
situation down there.
I mean,
it's not a binary situation.
You know, To go to Gabriel's point earlier, that you can both be empathetic and let's rather use the word compassionate. You can feel compassion for people who are suffering in Gaza, and you can also feel that Israel has the right to defend itself. Those are not mutually exclusive positions. But unfortunately, if you express any inkling of support for one side, or you show a little bit more feeling for one side in someone else's opinion than you do for the other, then you are immediately partisan, and there's no brooking that huge divide. There is also the question of Biden. And, you know, for a while now, the Middle East was improving. And I want to know whether you guys think any of this has to do with what's going on in America. We can't ignore America's role in the Middle East. People who are anti-Israel say that America foments this, that America gives all kinds of support, military, financial, and otherwise, to Israel at the expense of all its neighbors. There are also people on the opposite side of that who say if Israel didn't have America's support, they wouldn't be able to defend themselves. What do you guys make of America's role in this?
So if you there's a great report in the National Review which makes the argument that Israel is no longer being sponsored by America because like 90% of the money that America gives to Israel for defense, Israel has to spend on American arms. So this is really just America's way of funding itself. Israel has become rich enough that it can pay for its own military. And with the alliances that it started to form with the Sunni-led states like Saudi Arabia, it's no longer in the threatened position that it once was. So the aid, I'm not sure that it's real aid in some senses. In this sense, it is. We have a report, and you can in the business Business Day, Franz Krenier, the CEO of the IRR, writes about, amongst other things, the fact that the targeted missiles might be that are imported from America seem to be imported on a just-in-time basis, which is to say, it's not clear that Congress is going to release more of those. Short of that, Israel, if it gets targeted, especially by Hezbollah in Lebanon, which has at least 10 times more rockets than Hamas does in Gaza, their Iron Dome is going to take strain, and they're going to have to wipe out the rocket launch sites. But short of those targeted guided missiles, they're going to have to use more conventional weapons, which are sure to cause more conventional deaths. That's a problem. The other problem is that Iran, the mullahs of Tehran, have clearly been sponsoring terrorism, both with Hamas and Hezbollah. They want instability in the region. They want to humiliate the Sunnis. They want a sort of everyone to be conjoined again in an anti-Israeli stance in that region. And the biggest shift in American politics is that the Biden administration is trying once again to make a deal with Iran, which means they are less likely to censure any movements or support that Iran gives either to Hezbollah or Hamas on the ground. And that puts Iran in a stronger position. And that puts Palestinians, in my view, in a weaker position, because it means that they are more likely to have rockets falling over their head, either from, as it were, their own side or from the other side, because the major nefarious actor in the region, Iran, now has a reason to feel bolder than it did a year ago.
Pums, you get the last word for this episode of The Burning Platform. You want to wrap up the Middle East for us, or do you have anything to add to what Gabriel just said about the U.S. involvement?
Dude, I stand on my word, and Gabriel's very succinct summary of all of that is, it's a shit show, y'all, and people are unwilling to move from their positions of fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are the potential outcomes here, guys? Because either it's going to be all out war. I mean, if it's all out war, as you say, if Hezbollah start joining in this fight and Israel feels right, it's now or never, and they press a couple of buttons that really smoke the northern borders, then we've got open war. And I think that it's fairly clear that will be the most damaging for not only Israel's neighbors, but possibly for Israel itself. Although Israel, I suppose, in international relations terms, has nothing to lose anymore. Because most of the countries...
That's the problem with Bibi Netanyahu.
And in particular with Israel's growth towards something like non-racialism or non-religious affiliation as a defining factor in its politics.
Israelis.
Let me say Muslim... Arab-Israeli relations within Israel have been improving. For the first time, it was looking like the sort of leading Arab party was going to be part of the ruling coalition. Mm-hmm. That seemed like a viable option. And I think a lot of people know about the number of Arabs that have entered the Supreme Court and all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah.
That has been reversed
One-fifth of Israel's population are Arab Israelis. Yes.
And that's already been reversed. That trust that I was talking about earlier, that trust has already been eroded seriously, including by Israeli police, I think, acting badly, but really by this opening up of the conflict. And if it gets to a stage of all-out war, then I think that one of the saddest things from an Israeli perspective is going to be that neighbors don't trust each other again. And that could lead to violence on a greater scale. But even if it doesn't, it just undermines what that country needs to thrive, which is a kind of content of character judgment one of another, where you take care of your neighbors. Doesn't matter how they look or who they pray to, because you belong together. This is you live together and you must work together and love each other and go into the same parks. I mean, that sounds all very cushy and silly, but I was just in Emerentia Park yesterday. It's so nice. It's so nice to be in a part of South Africa which is super diverse and everyone's getting along and pushing their prams and flying their kites. That really is a kind of litmus test for the health of a society. And I think that apply that litmus test to Israel in a year, and it's going to have a very different outcome if there is all-out conflict. And if you get the wrong result on that test, I think political accountability, reason-responsive government, and true liberty really do become impossible.
All right, guys, I'm going to wrap it up there, and thank you. If we'd have avoided and ignored the question of Israel and Gaza, we would have been making all the overtures to those people who say, oh, you're not talking about it, you're trying to avoid it. The fact is, I am trying to avoid it. It doesn't lead to any positive moves on social media. You end up becoming polarized by both sides in terms of what your position is. Other people put words in your mouth. It's just horrible. This is it for me talking about the Middle East until we absolutely have to again. Because unfortunately, the result for those of us who don't have a dog in the fight, I've said this before in terms of my own position, I do not have a dog in this fight. The problem is, because it's so absolutely abysmal in terms of how partisan people become, those of us who might want to have an opinion about this, those of us who might care about things there, are loath to enter the conversation. And therefore, I'm closing this chapter on Israel and Gaza. I'm not interested in talking about it again on the show. I'm going to pretend it doesn't exist, which is not helpful, I know. But I'm just not prepared to go there anymore. And thank you, Pumi and Gabriel. Your analysis of everything here this morning has been tremendously useful. And well done on that report, Gabriel. It's very interesting stuff. Looking forward to reading it as Pumi did. She's really good about this. She read it last night. I'll read it today. Okay, guys, have a happy day. Pumi, thank you. Gabriel, thank you. Most especially thank you to you for joining us. We will see you tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. CliffCentral.com.